Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, Bob Doty, Steve Ember, and Shirley Griffith. But first, this report. The United States Department of Education has launched an investigation into Harvard University and Yale University. Earlier this month, the agency announced the schools had failed to report hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign gifts and contracts. Yale University is in New Haven, Connecticut. It may not have reported at least $375 million in foreign money over the last 4 years, officials said in a statement. They are also concerned that Harvard, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, may not have fully met reporting requirements. This is about transparency, U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos said in a statement. If colleges and universities are accepting foreign money and gifts, their students, donors, and taxpayers deserve to know how much and from whom. Federal law requires most colleges and universities to report gifts from and contracts with foreign sources twice a year if the amount is more than $250,000.
Reed Rubenstein is the head of the Education Department's legal team. He recently sent a letter to Yale President Peter Salovey. The letter accused the university of not reporting a single foreign source gift or contract from 2014 to 2017. Yet the school operates in many countries. The letter requested all records from the school related to gifts or contracts from Saudi Arabia, Saudi nationals, China, Huawei Technologies, and ZTE. Huawei and ZTE are two major Chinese technology companies that aim to provide worldwide systems for the high-speed phone and internet network called 5G. The companies were placed on a U.S. sanctions list last year. The U.S. has said Huawei is a national security threat, and President Donald Trump has been highly critical of the company. Reed Rubenstein sent a similar letter to Harvard President Lawrence Bacow. Rubenstein said the Education Department knew of information suggesting Harvard University lacks appropriate institutional controls. The letter comes shortly after an investigation into Charles M. Lieber, the head of Harvard University's chemistry department. Lieber was charged with lying to federal officials about financial support or grants he had received from China. The Education Department requested all records linked to the Thousand Talents Recruitment Program and the Wuhan University of Technology. These Chinese organizations gave him the grants. Lieber was arrested on January 28th and released early this month on a $1 million bond.
The investigation of Yale and Harvard is part of a larger examination by the Department of Education. The agency says since July, its enforcement efforts have led to the reporting of nearly $6.5 billion in formerly undisclosed foreign money. Much of that money came from China, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. This sum may be significantly underestimated, the Education Department said. Karen Pert is a spokeswoman for Yale University. She confirmed the school had received a request from the department for records of some foreign gifts and contracts under Section 117 of the Higher Education Act of 1965. We are reviewing the request and preparing to respond to it, Pert told reporters. Harvard spokesman Jonathan Swain made a similar confirmation. He said that the school had received a notice of investigation from the agency and was also preparing an answer.
Last year, the department also sent letters to several other schools. They included Georgetown University, Texas A&M University, Cornell University, Rutgers University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the University of Maryland. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories, our weekly program about common, everyday expressions in American English. During the next few weeks, many people in South America will celebrate Carnival. It is a time of music and dancing. The party ends before the Christian observance of Ash Wednesday, which this year falls on February 26. Ash Wednesday has a very different feeling than Carnival. It is meant to be a day of prayer, sorrow, and asking for forgiveness. In American English, guilt or sadness is often expressed by the symbol of ashes, the gray matter left over from a fire. For example, if you are feeling really bad about something you did, you might say, "You are wearing sackcloth and ashes." The phrase is repeated in several places in the Bible, the Christian Holy Book. The word sackcloth refers to a kind of clothing that feels rough on the skin. It was sometimes made of goat hair. Wearing something made of sackcloth was a sign that a person was trying to punish himself. As for the ashes part, the willingness to be touched by dirty material showed that a person was humble and that he understood he would someday die. Yes, the image is pretty serious. You can use the expression in a somewhat serious way, too. Let's say you forgot that you invited your boyfriend or girlfriend to a special birthday date. Your beloved waited for you. For hours, crying, in the rain. Much later, you sit up in bed and remember your missed appointment. You immediately call your partner and say that you are so sorry. You promise to wear sackcloth and ashes for the rest of the month. Of course, you do not really have to put on a shirt made of animal hair, but you could show you are sorry in a different way. Maybe you cook your partner dinner every night for a week, or buy a meaningful gift. You can also use the phrase sackcloth and ashes in a sarcastic way. This means you say it, but do not really mean it. Let's say you have done some very small bad thing, like borrowed your coworker's coffee cup without asking, and now she won't let you forget it. Every time you walk by, she holds her cup close to her and gives you an angry look. She also tells all your other coworkers not to trust you with any of their supplies, such as pens or plastic spoons. At the next team meeting, she asks your boss for a lock so she can keep her cup safe from you. "Okay, okay," you might say. "I'm sorry. Do I have to wear sackcloth and ashes?" Your angry coworker just might say yes. She is clearly enjoying raking you over the ashes. In other words, she repeatedly brings up a past mistake. The phrase calls to mind a fire that has almost gone out, but that can be started again with a little effort. Of course, being sarcastic is not always a good idea. It rarely makes other people want to forgive you. You would probably be better off apologizing honestly to your coworker. But saying something nice when you are angry can be difficult. The sweet words might turn to ashes in your mouth. In fact, as an expression, anything can turn to ashes. A hopeful feeling, a relationship, maybe even your job if your coworker keeps complaining about you. All can dry up and disappear. Fortunately, most things can also rise from the ashes. In other words, what was thought to be dead or destroyed can return to life, often in a new and better way. That is a good image to remember during periods of difficulty or loss. Usually, the situation does not last. In time, things get better, and you might soon find yourself playing music and dancing again. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
France is experiencing an unusually moderate winter, which has led to low snowfall in ski areas across the country. One affected ski area is Les Mortilles in the Pyrenees Mountains of southern France. The lack of snow has forced the resort to temporarily close its ski runs at the height of the winter season. Local restaurants and hotels are seeking fewer visitors. People who do come to the area are seeking to do other things besides skiing. Warmer temperatures have made hiking one of the most popular activities. Recent daytime temperatures at Les Mortilles have reached 10 degrees Celsius. Some hikers even removed winter clothing while making their way across mountain areas containing very little snow. "Skiing, no one today can guarantee it," said hotel operator François Giezou. "If the snow is not here, we have to sell something else." He has been making money by renting out two-wheeled scooters to help visitors in the area have fun. The scooters can be ridden down grassy mountain hills. They come with equipment made for riding on snow, but Giezou has attached bicycle wheels instead. His ski rental equipment remains untouched. He says he has had to reduce the hours of some workers and expects business losses during the season to drop as much as 15%. Many people in the area believe the latest winter is more than just a bad year. The last time France experienced such a mild December and January was in 1900, French weather officials say. Christelle Robert is an official with Météo France, the country's national weather service. She told Reuters that mild winters and less snow seem to be a clear sign of global warming. Scientists have predicted a continued rise in world temperatures. People connected to the area's ski industry are considering a future with much less snow. If such weather continues, ski resorts around 1,600 meters above sea level will be so warm that they will not even be able to use artificial snow because it will melt. Some of the higher Pyrenees resorts did receive enough snow recently to open for business. But the Le Mortiz resort sits at 1,350 meters, putting it in a so-called melt area. "It's the second year in a row that we've had no snow," said Laurent Morel, a visitor from the city of Toulouse, who was walking on the mountainside with his family. "We love the mountains, so we come anyway." I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith talk about Calvin Coolidge and how he became President of the United States.
The early 1920s were a troubled time for the United States. Congress and the public began to discover crimes by several officials in the administration of President Warren Harding. Harding himself became seriously sick during a trip to Alaska and western states. He died in a hotel room in California in August 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, became the new president. Both men were Republicans. Their policies on issues were much the same. Coolidge, however, was a very different man. He was completely honest. He was the kind of president the country needed to rebuild public trust in the government.
Calvin Coolidge was quiet and plain-looking. He was the son of a farmer and political leader from the small northeastern state of Vermont. Young Calvin worked at different jobs to pay for his college education. He became a lawyer. He moved to another northeastern state, Massachusetts, where he became active in Republican Party politics. First, he was elected mayor of the town. Then he was elected to the state legislature. Finally, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. It was as governor that Coolidge first became known throughout the United States.
In 1919, a group of policemen in the city of Boston tried to start a labor union. This violated the rules of the police department. So the commissioner of police suspended 19 of the union's leaders. The next day, almost 75% of Boston's policemen went on strike. Criminals walked freely through the city for two nights. They robbed stores and threatened public safety. Frightened Americans all across the country waited to see what Governor Coolidge would do.
He took strong action. He called on state troops to end the strike. He said, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, any time. Most Americans approved of what Coolidge did. The people of Massachusetts supported him, too. They re-elected him governor by a large number of votes. Then, in 1920, Republicans nominated Warren Harding for president. They nominated Calvin Coolidge for vice president. When President Harding died in California, Coolidge, his wife, and two sons moved to the White House.
America's 30th president was, in some ways, an unusual kind of person to lead the country. He said little. He showed few feelings. Coolidge's policies as president were not active. He tried to start as few new programs as possible. He was a conservative Republican who believed deeply that government should be small. Coolidge expressed his belief this way: if the federal government should go out of existence, most people would not note the difference. And once, he said, 4/5 of our troubles in this life would disappear if we would only sit down and keep still.
Coolidge believed that private business, not the federal government, should lead the country to greater wealth and happiness. He continued President Harding's policy of supporting American business both inside the United States and in other countries. The government under President Coolidge continued high taxes on imports in an effort to help American companies.
Many Americans shared Coolidge's ideas about small government and big business. In the early 1920s, many of them were living better than ever before. At that time, companies were growing larger. The prices of their stocks rose higher and higher. There were lots of jobs, and the wages of many workers increased. Americans agreed with their president that there was little need for government spending and government programs when private industry seemed so strong.
The American economy grew in the 1920s for several reasons. The World War had destroyed many factories and businesses in Europe. The United States did not suffer the same destruction. It was still a young country. It had great natural resources, trained workers, and a huge market within its own borders. When peace came, Americans found their economy stronger than any other in the world.
Changes in the American market also helped economic growth. Installment buying became popular. In this system, people could buy a product and pay for it over a period of several weeks or months. The total cost was higher because they had to pay interest. But the system made it possible for more people to buy more goods. It also made the idea of borrowing money more acceptable to many Americans.
The growing importance of the New York stock markets also helped economic growth in the 1920s. Millions of Americans bought shares of stock in companies that seemed to grow bigger every month. Such investment almost became a national game. People would buy shares of stock, then sell them when the stock rose in value. There were many stories of poor people who became rich overnight by buying the right stocks. The American Congress also helped the economy by lowering income taxes. People had more money to spend on new goods. Another important reason for economic growth was a change in the way American companies were operated.
During the 1920s, the idea of manufacturing goods in the most scientific way became very popular. The father of this idea of scientific management was an engineer, Frederick Taylor. Mr. Taylor developed a system to study manufacturing. He studied each machine involved in the process. He studied how much work each person did. He studied how goods moved from one part of a factory to another. Then he offered ideas to business owners about ways to produce goods faster and for less cost.
Taylor's ideas of scientific management appealed to business owners. Automobile manufacturer Henry Ford proved that the ideas could work in his new car factory in the state of Michigan. Ford used the assembly line system of production. In this system, each worker did one thing to a product as it moved through the factory. This helped cut prices and increase wages.
Ford and other businessmen learned a great deal about how to control costs, set prices, and decide how much to produce. All these changes in production and marketing helped Ford and other American companies grow larger and stronger. Henry Ford's Model T car became popular throughout the country. So did other new products, radios, refrigerators for cooling food, vacuums to clean carpets, ready-made cigarettes, beauty products. Americans in the 1920s began to buy all kinds of new products they had never used before.
Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. However, business led the nation. Times were good. Americans trusted business and its leaders. It became an honor to call someone a businessman. Colleges organized business classes. Middle-class citizens in almost every city and town gathered to discuss business ideas. President Coolidge spoke for millions of Americans when he said, "The chief business of the American people is business."
Coolidge represented traditional values and a simple way of life. He knew exactly how every dollar he earned was saved or spent, and he spent no more money than was necessary. The strange thing was that Coolidge was extremely popular with a public that was spending large amounts of money. Some economic experts warned that the country's quick economic growth would end in economic depression. Most Americans, however, believed that the good times had come to stay. They enjoyed the good things in life that work and success in business could bring. On our next program, we will see how the economic growth of the 1920s brought exciting changes to the day-to-day life of millions of Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.